coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms, West Oakland. As I speak with you today, this September 8th of the year of coronavirus 2020, the year of the never-ending destructive forest fire here in California, the skies are a very ominous gray, and there's a red sun kind of piercing through, and it just feels very doomy. That's why I chose to open up with this doomy soundtrack. That being said, I do have a guest for today's show. His name is Richard Rothstein, and he wrote a book that I really love called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. I read this book probably about 3 years ago when I saw Richard Rothstein on a show on, I believe it was called the Real News Network, which is a pretty good channel on YouTube. I suggest you check it out. And in it, he was talking about housing segregation in Richmond, California. If you've listened to this show before, you know that I am from, grew up in Richmond, California. And my family grew up in Richmond, California, and I love where I'm from. It's definitely got its issues. It's definitely got its problems, but we all love where we're from, right? That being said, he tells a story in this book of a Richmond that I never really understood, because the Richmond I understood definitely was crime-ridden. It was scary. But I didn't know why. And when you're growing up, you think you know why. You think you understand these factors that lead to crime, that lead to poverty. But in this book, it really definitely explains how the United States government created segregated neighborhoods. And as many people that listen to the show probably know a little bit about the history of redlining, this book definitely takes a deeper dive. And he does it with great journalistic integrity. And he tells these stories. And I think through these stories, you get a better glimpse of the generations of poverty that were created by a lot of these policies. And I just want to, before I get into the interview, I just want to read a little bit from the book. So the book opens up in California. I think when we think of California, we think of this utopia of progressive thinking, a blue state. We don't really think of segregated, whites only, no opportunity for blacks. That's not the California I think we think of when we think of the state. So he starts it off with the story of a man named Frank Stevenson. And Frank Stevenson is one of the black people that left the South to come to California for opportunity. There was a lot of ports in the Bay Area, California especially. Of course, it's a coastal state. And we built here a lot of the machinery for the Second World War. So as our white brothers and sisters are getting drafted to go fight, they're running out of people to work. So of course you have women, Rosie the Riveter, and you also have a lot of black people coming from the South working in these shipyards. This gentleman, Frank Stevenson, was one of those people. This is from the book, The Color of Law. This chapter is called, If San Francisco, Then Everywhere. For black workers like Frank Stevenson, who couldn't squeeze into the limited number of public housing units, there were no war, guest, or other supplemental government programs. Mr. Stevenson, like many African Americans in Richmond who did not get into segregated public projects, lived in North Richmond, an unincorporated area for which the city provided no services. He boarded with an elderly woman with whom he traded maintenance for rent. Other black war workers in North Richmond, not as fortunate as Frank Stevenson, remained in cardboard shacks, barns, tents, or even open fields. Black workers who earned steady wages at war industries could save to buy small plots in unincorporated North Richmond, but because the federal government refused to insure bank loans made to African Americans for housing, Standard Construction was unaffordable. Some built their own dwellings with orange crates or scrap lumber, scores from the shipyards. By the early 1950s, some 4,000 African Americans in North Richmond were still living in these makeshift homes. During the war, the government also collaborated with private groups to segregate Richmond. The United Service Organization, USO, maintained separate black and white clubs in Richmond for military personnel and also operated separate black and white travelers' aid services for newly arrived war workers. On one occasion, in 1943, the USO proposed a service center for African Americans on property that was available in a white neighborhood. The local newspaper, the Richmond Independent, protested. A petition drive in opposition to the plan ensued, and the city council prevented the plan from going forward. Although the USO was and is a private organization, it was organized by President Roosevelt, who at the time had held the title of honorary chairman, benefited from the use of government buildings for some of its clubs, coordinated its services with the War Department, and had a congressional charter. Along with the city council's action, the tight federal government nexus rendered the USO's practice of segregation in Richmond and elsewhere an aspect of de jure segregation. To ensure that no African Americans migrated to Richmond unless they were essential to the war effort, the city's police stopped African American men on the street and then arrested and jailed them if they couldn't prove they were employed. So after joining his older brother Alan in Richmond, Frank Stevenson quickly located a job at Ford Motor Assembly Plant that had been taken over by the government for the manufacture of military jeeps and the refurbishing of damaged tanks. In the 1930s, the Ford plant had a sign in front, "No Mexican or black workers wanted." But when Frank Stevenson arrived in 1944, his services were badly needed. 3 years earlier, the United Auto Workers, the UAW, had forced Henry Ford to the bargaining table, and at the war's end, a union contract prevented Ford Motor from firing African Americans to make way for returning white veterans or for white workers who had been laid off from military production in places like the shipyards. So in 1945, when the Army gave up control of the plant and the Ford Motor Company began to make cars again, black workers who had been hired during the war were able to stay on with secure industrial jobs. Ford had established the plant in 1931 after Richmond offered the company tax initiatives to lure its Northern California assembly operations. The city had a deep water port, that's why it became a shipbuilding center during the war, and Ford found the site attractive because it was accessible both to ocean freighters and to railroads. The company could inexpensively transport parts from Detroit to Richmond for assembly into cars and light trucks, and then ship the completed vehicles from Richmond to dealers in Northern California and Hawaii. The Richmond plant was two stories tall, with conveyor belts moving parts and sub-assemblies from one floor to the other. When they were first hired during the war, black workers were assigned only to the lowest and most strenuous job classifications, but the union fought to open more skilled assignments to African Americans. Frank Stevenson seems to have been among the most ambitious and talented, and within a decade of being employed, he was sufficiently skilled to fill in when workers at different workstations were at lunch. Quote, "I was smart enough," Mr. Stevenson says, "to go do the other jobs on my break and say, let me see what you do. That's why they made me the utility man." In the 1950s, as the post-war consumer boom created growing demand for automobiles, Ford's Michigan plant had no room to expand. Highways made underdeveloped rural areas accessible, and land was cheap, allowing Ford the opportunity to spread out and eliminate the inefficiencies of multi-story buildings. So in 1953, the company announced it would close its Richmond plant and reestablish operations in a larger facility 50 miles south in Milpitas, a suburb of San Jose, rural at the time. So for those that don't know, Milpitas is kind of the outskirts of what we now call Silicon Valley. I believe Facebook is not too far away from there. Ford purchased a 160-acre site from the Western Pacific Railroad, which had bought 1,700 acres in hopes of attracting industrial facilities for a rail hub. Union leaders met with Ford executives and negotiated an agreement permitting all 1,400 Richmond plant workers, including the approximately 250 African Americans, to transfer to the new facility. Once Ford's plans became known, Milpitas residents incorporated the town and passed an emergency ordinance permitting the newly installed city council to ban apartment construction and allow only single-family homes. Developers then set to work creating subdivisions of inexpensive single-family houses for workers not only at Ford, but at the other plants that Western Pacific had drawn to the area. The builders went to the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, for approval of their subdivision plans and then used these approvals to get banks to issue low-interest loans to finance construction. If the houses conformed to its specifications, the federal government then granted mortgages to qualified buyers without a further property appraisal. Although banks would generally make mortgage loans to affluent buyers without government involvement, they usually shied away from making loans to working class families unless the mortgages were insured. With reduced risk, banks offered lower interest rates, making ownership more affordable to working class families. For veterans, government approval also usually meant that no down payment was required. As in Rollingwood, 10 years earlier, one of the federal government's specifications for mortgages insured in Milpitas was an openly stated prohibition on sales to African Americans. Because Milpitas had no apartments and houses in the area were off limits to black workers, though their incomes and economic circumstances were like those of whites on the assembly line, African Americans at Ford had to choose between giving up their good industrial jobs, moving to apartments in the segregated neighborhood of San Jose, or enduring lengthy commutes between North Richmond and Milpitas. Frank Stevenson bought a van, recruited eight others to share the costs, and made the drive daily for the next 20 years until he retired. The trip took more than an hour each way. Of Frank Stevenson and his eight carpoolers, only one was ever able to move out further south, closer to the plant, and he was not able to do so until the late 1960s. He found a home in Hayward, a town about halfway between Richmond and Milpitas, that had also previously been closed to African Americans. As a civilian housing shortage eased after the war, and more government-subsidized suburbs like Rollingwood were built for white working-class families, Richmond itself became a predominantly black city. As the black population of North Richmond swelled, African Americans began to break into the South Richmond housing market. Soon, South Richmond, as well, became part of Richmond's ghetto. In 1970, after his daughters finished high school, Frank Stevenson was finally able to buy his first home in the southern, previously whites-only section of the city. Wow. Again, the book is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America by Richard Rothstein. I suggest you go get it. Please stay tuned to my interview with Richard Rothstein. Thank you very much. All All right, coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. And today I am so lucky to have a guest that I've been wanting to speak with for some time. I picked up this this gentleman's book a few years ago. I want to say about three years ago when I saw him speaking on the Real News Network on a YouTube program. And he was talking about housing segregation in the United States. And he was talking about the city that I grew up in, Richmond, California. So without further ado, I know he doesn't have a lot of time. I'd like to introduce Richard Rothstein. Thank you very much for joining me today. Just to give you guys a quick rundown on who Mr. Rothstein is. Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow emeritus at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He's the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, which recovers a forgotten history of how federal, state, and local policy explicitly segregated metropolitan areas nationwide, creating racially homogeneous neighborhoods in patterns that violate the Constitution. Ooh, that's a lot.
Good to be with you.
So in this book, it pretty much starts off, you start talking about the San Francisco Bay Area. And I think when most people think of segregation and housing, I think we have a vision of strictly the South. We definitely don't think about the northern region of the country, and we definitely don't think about the West Coast. So for your book to pretty much start in the San Francisco Bay Area in Richmond, California, were you kind of blown away about what you found as well?
I was pretty astounded, not by the individual policies, because I knew many of them, but by the way in which so many federal, state, and local policies that were racially explicit worked together to create segregation in every metropolitan area in this country, certainly not the South exclusively or even particularly. This was a northern, a western, a midwestern phenomenon, all done by federal, state, and local policy.
And there's been some recent books and definitely articles kind of talking about the New Deal and public works. And I don't know if you've read or seen Torrey Reed Jr.'s book, Towards Freedom. He definitely talks a lot about public works programs. He definitely doesn't bring up what you bring up about how public works were a part of this segregation of housing. When we look back at the New Deal, and its somewhat complicated legacy, do you find the New Deal to be very, totally exclusionary?
Well, it's complicated. The New Deal provided benefits in a number of areas to working class families that had never been provided by the federal government before. But it was always segregated. When the New Deal created public housing for the first time in 1933, that was the first public housing that had ever been created in this country for civilians. Previous governments, previous administrations hadn't been involved in the housing market. So it was a mixed blessing. On the one hand, On the one hand, the federal government was providing benefits to segments of the population that hadn't previously received them. On the other hand, it was doing so on a segregated basis that had long-run consequences that were very, very damaging. As you probably know, the African-American voting population overwhelmingly opposed Franklin Roosevelt's election in 1932. They supported Herbert Hoover by large margins. By 1936, the African-American voting population had flipped and was now supporting the Democratic Party because it was getting benefits that it had never before been getting, and most people felt that segregated benefits were better than no benefits at all. But the long-run consequences of providing benefits on a segregated basis had disastrous effects. It created problems that are very, very difficult to overcome once we've segregated the country. The achievement gap in schools, for example, that arises because we concentrate the most disadvantaged young children in single neighborhoods where they have social and economic disadvantages that overwhelm the school's ability to try to deal with them. Health disparities between blacks and whites, because so many African Americans live in more polluted, more unhealthy neighborhoods, less access to fresh food. It predicts the mass incarceration and police abuse that we spent so much time in the last couple of months demonstrating against in the Black Lives Matter demonstrations. That kind of abuse might still exist to some extent, but not nearly to the extent that it does in segregated neighborhoods where we concentrate the most disadvantaged young men in single neighborhoods without access to jobs or transportation even to get to good jobs or opportunity to attend schools that have high achievement. And the segregation that we created is also responsible, I think, for the very, very dangerous, frightening political polarization that we have in this country today. How can we ever expect to develop the common national identity that we need to preserve this democracy if so many African Americans and whites live so far from each other that they can't empathize with each other, they can't understand each other's life experiences? To create, as I say, a common national identity is essential for the preservation of a democracy. So it was a big price that we paid for providing the first publicly financed housing, providing jobs in various work programs that are always segregated during the New Deal, a big price that we paid for doing it in that way.
Now, another thing you actually bring up when you talk about early public housing is that a lot of those early developments were built in integrated neighborhoods. And I believe you have, was it Langston Hughes?
Yes, that's correct.
Where he dated, I think it was his first girlfriend was a young Jewish girl or well, friend.
I don't know if he counted his girlfriends, but really, he did date a Jewish girl in high school. He said his best friend was Polish. This was in his autobiography. He recounted this. Like many areas, the central neighborhood of Cleveland was a fairly integrated neighborhood in the early 20th century. It was we had integrated neighborhoods in downtown areas of cities all across the country because we were a manufacturing economy at that time. And factories, most jobs had to be located near a deep water port or a railroad terminal to get the parts or ship their final products. Mm-hmm. And workers, black and white, didn't have automobiles to get to work, and so they had to live close enough to their workplaces to either walk or get there by a streetcar, short streetcar rides. Cleveland was a neighborhood like that. The central neighborhood of Cleveland was about half black and half white. The Public Works Administration, the very first New Deal agency, built the first civilian housing in this country, public housing in this country. One of the places it built it was in the central neighborhood of Cleveland, where it created two separate projects, one for blacks, one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation that with that and other projects it built elsewhere in Cleveland that persists to this day. And this was done all over. I don't want you to think that I pick on the Bay Area. I like to pick on any place that's a self-satisfied, smug place that thinks it's better than every place. Bay Area is just one of them. But in the book, as you may recall, I described Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes.
The area between Harvard and MIT, the Central Square neighborhood, was a fully integrated neighborhood in the 1930s. The Public Works Administration demolished housing there. And the government built two separate projects, one for blacks and one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation that persists with those and other projects to this day. In the West, going back to the West Coast, during World War II, hundreds of thousands of workers flocked to war plants on the West Coast. There were very few African Americans living on the West Coast prior to World War II. Historians talk about the second great migration, which brought blacks for the first time to the West Coast. If the government wanted the planes and the ships to be produced, it had to provide housing for these workers, and it did. Everywhere, it built segregated housing for war workers, creating on the San Francisco Bay Area, for example, a pattern of segregation that hadn't previously existed because there were so few African Americans to segregate. In San Francisco, the government built five projects for war workers, mostly shipyard workers. Four were for whites only, one for African Americans in the Fillmore District, which became the black neighborhood of San Francisco. And in Portland and Seattle and Los Angeles, the same thing was done to create segregation where it hadn't previously existed on the West Coast with housing for war workers.
Have you seen, on a side note, have you seen the movie The Last Black Man in San Francisco?
No, I haven't.
Have you heard about it?
No, I haven't. No.
I think Danny Glover was behind the production of it. Might have been one of the producers, but it's a very beautifully shot movie. Actually, kind of to your point about the Fillmore being this black area, for those that don't know, there was a great migration west from the South. Oakland, Richmond, and San Francisco is where Los Angeles is where a lot of black people ended up landing. My grandparents landing in Richmond, California, because I think in your book you said that was the biggest shipyard in the country.
Yes.
And also a lot of black families landed in San Francisco. And this movie tells the story of not how a black family lost their home, but what San Francisco now resembles for their black population, and one young man kind of trying to hang on to his family's kind of forgotten legacy with this one house. So if you get a chance, you should check it out.
Yes, I will. I will look it up.
But as we talk about these migration patterns to the West, and you do have these two great stories where you're talking about a black family that actually gets into a white neighborhood in the Richmond area, and a black family that gets into this massive development in, I believe it was New York, Levittown.
Mm-hmm.
And in both instances, they're met with extreme opposition from the neighbors, to the point where there's hundreds of people, you know, throwing rocks at them, yelling at them. Was a cross burned?
Yes. Yes. And a Nazi swastikas painted on adjoining houses.
And this is like right after World War II as well.
Yes. But the important thing to remember about this is that this violence, which occurred in hundreds and hundreds of places across the country, was police protected. Frequently, police organized and led. And so every one of these instances, and there were, like I say, hundreds and hundreds of them all across the country, where the police protected mob violence to drive African Americans out of homes that they had legitimately purchased or rented in white neighborhoods, every one of them was a violation of the Constitution, a violation of the 14th Amendment, because it was police instigated and protected. It's a civil rights violation. It gives the lie to the myth of de facto segregation, that somehow the segregation only happened by accident or naturally. Much of it was in addition to the policies that we talked about a few minutes ago, where the federal government was creating segregation with its housing programs. Local governments were creating it with their police forces. And all of these were civil rights violations, violations of the Constitution. And as American citizens, we have an obligation to remedy all of them. If we take our responsibilities of citizenship seriously, we have to remedy constitutional violations. And we've never done so.
And it seems to be easy for people not to think of the constitutional violation, because I don't think the vision we have of public housing is one of this de jure segregation, as you call it. Like, when you, in one of your talks, I saw a few of your YouTube talks, you talk about, well, what do you think of when you think of public housing? And you probably think of these very large 20, 30 story buildings that are filled with, you know, poor people, and they're very violent, and the neighborhoods around them are all run down. And you're like, that's not the initial vision of what public housing was.
No, public housing.
Go ahead.
Public housing was not created for poor people. Poor people weren't permitted into public housing when it was created. In the Great Depression, the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, we had a 25% unemployment rate, but public housing was for the 75% of working families who were employed, but who couldn't find housing because there's so little construction going on in the Depression. That was the purpose of public housing. The families in public housing paid the full cost of the housing in their rent. It wasn't subsidized the way public housing is today. It was, as I say, for working class families, but it was always done on a segregated basis. You know, in my book, The Color of Law, at the very beginning of the book, I have a photograph of Franklin Roosevelt handing keys to the 100,000th family who receive a public housing unit in this country in the 1930s. And you can see by the crowd surrounding the family itself, this is an all-white, middle-class, lower-middle-class crowd who occupy public housing. There were some projects separately, as I mentioned before, that were built for African-Americans, but most public housing in its initial stages was for whites only on a segregated basis.
It's insane, because that's not the way we think of public housing, even in this country to this day. I work with the unhoused population here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the housing that we have for them definitely is not the housing that you describe in that aspect of your book. And even from what I know about projects like Pruitt-Igoe in the St. Louis area, initially they looked a lot different than what they ended up becoming before they were blown up.
Well, you mentioned Pruitt-Igoe. I just, not to belabor the obvious, but there was no project Pruitt-Igoe. They were two separate projects. Pruitt was for African-Americans. Igoe was for whites. The only reason it became all black was because the federal government embarked on another racially explicit policy to move white working-class families out of those projects into single-family homes in all white suburbs. And that was also an explicit racial policy of the federal government. The developers of these white suburbs, you mentioned Levittown before, the developers could never have assembled the capital to build these projects on their own. These were giant projects. The first Levittown east of New York City was 17,000 homes. No bank was going to be crazy enough to lend Levitt the money to build 17,000 homes in one place, for which he had no buyers. We weren't even a suburban country at that time, and nobody had any idea that it would even be interested in living in such places. The only way that these developers could get the capital to build the homes, to buy the land, was to go to the Federal Housing Administration and, after World War II, the Veterans Administration, submit their plans for the development, the architectural designs they were going to use, the layout of the streets, and an explicit commitment never to sell a home to an African American. This was the federal government, let me say, also in many of these developments required the developers to place a clause in the deed prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. This was an explicit racial policy. This notion of de facto segregation that just sort of happened by accident is utter nonsense. There's no basis in reality to it whatsoever. This wasn't the action of rogue bureaucrats either. The Federal Housing Administration had a manual that was distributed to appraisers all across the country whose job it was to evaluate the applications of developers for federal bank guarantees. The manual prohibited appraisers from recommending bank guarantees by the federal government for developers who would sell to African Americans. The manual even prohibited bank guarantees for developers who were going to build an all-white subdivision that was located near where African Americans were living, because in the words of the manual, that would run the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups. That's what the manual said, the federal manual said. This notion of de facto segregation, as I said, is utter nonsense. There's no basis in reality to it whatsoever.
Now, when we speak about history, people try to say, well, that was a long time ago. Things are better now. And you recently wrote an article for The Times about the Trump administration's new housing rules that you think will worsen the segregation that we already have.
Well, I think there's something else I have to say about that. The rule is not the most important thing. The reason this is not a historical curiosity, but it determines the structure of American society today, is that those subdivisions that I was talking about a minute ago, like Levittown, or like any of them in the San Francisco Bay Area.
If Rollingwood, yeah.
Well, yeah, or you know, Westlake and Daly City, which is also 15,000 homes. Or San Lorenzo. Any of these developments sold at the time very inexpensively. They were cost about $8,000-$9,000, sometimes $10,000. They were modest working class homes, 750 square feet. Today, those homes sell for $400,000-$500,000. In the Bay Area, sometimes $1 million. The white families who bought those homes gained over the next couple of generations equity from the appreciation in the value of their homes. Most families in this country, not the very rich, but most families in this country have any wealth at all, have it from the equity they have in their homes. The white families who were subsidized by the federal government on a racially explicit basis, African-Americans prohibited from participating in this program, gained over the next couple of generations this wealth, this equity. They used it to send their children to college. They used it to perhaps take care of temporary emergencies like maybe unemployment for a short period or medical problems. They used it to subsidize their own retirements, and they used it to bequeath wealth to their children and grandchildren, who then had down payments for their own homes. Mm-hmm. African Americans were prohibited from participating in this policy. Well, today, African American incomes on average are about 60% of white incomes. There's a whole story behind that. I won't go into that now, but you'd think that people with similar incomes would have similar wealth. But the reality is that while African American incomes are 60% of white incomes on average, African American wealth is about 5% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity between the 60% income ratio and the 5% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that we have never remedied. And that we have an obligation to remedy, because it's a constitutional violation. So that's the wealth gap determines the racial inequality we have in so many areas of life. You know, achievement gap in schools from concentrating the most disadvantaged children in single schools, health disparities between blacks and whites, because so many African Americans live in less healthy neighborhoods with more pollution, mass incarceration and police abuse, which might still exist to some extent, but not nearly to the extent it does when we concentrate the most disadvantaged young people in single neighborhoods without access to jobs and transportation. So that's the reason why this is not a historical curiosity. That wealth gap that we created with explicit federal racial policy, unconstitutional policy, has never been remedied. And it determines the racial inequality that we have today.
And do you think COVID is just exacerbating this on a whole nother level?
Well, certainly. Once you create segregation, as we have done, our country has done, our government has done on our behalf. Once we create segregation, you can have race-neutral policies or events that exacerbate it. So COVID is not a racial disease. It's not that it affects blacks more than whites, but its transmission is much greater in overcrowded neighborhoods. So if you create segregation in which African Americans have less adequate housing than whites, it's inevitable that the infection rates of a pandemic like the COVID one is going to be greater in African-American neighborhoods than in white neighborhoods, simply because they're more overcrowded. It's more difficult to engage in social distancing.
Do you see any, if you know, the election's coming up in November, and it's a big election, right? We're either going to get four more years of Donald Trump, or we get 4 years of a possible Joe Biden administration. Do you see either administration even mildly attempting to try to remedy what you talk about so much in your book with the racial segregation, especially being that COVID, you know, we still don't know how bad it's going to be, that this moratorium has been lifted on evictions. So we could be looking at a horrible homeless crisis as well that definitely is going to be affecting the black community disproportionately.
Well, in some respects, it's possible that a new Democratic administration, if it addresses, for example, evictions and homelessness to a greater extent than the present administration, might make a difference, but in general, it won't make much of a difference because there is no political support today in this country for aggressive policies to redress segregation. What we need, for example, is an affirmative action program in housing, which is what our Constitution requires in the case of a violation like this. The federal government should be subsidizing African Americans to move to neighborhoods that are now unaffordable to them, but that would have been affordable at the time that the neighborhoods were created, that whites were subsidized to move into them and African Americans were prohibited. But there's no political support in either party for programs like that. So we need a new civil rights movement in this country that's going to make it uncomfortable to maintain the patterns of segregation we have. I certainly think that a Democratic administration is more likely to be sympathetic to a new civil rights movement than the current administration. But sympathy alone won't do it if the civil rights movement isn't organized and powerful and determined to make it uncomfortable to maintain the present racial boundaries that we have in this country. So that's our need.
Interesting. And do you have any new books in the works?
Well, yes, I'm working on a new book that describes how to create such a civil rights movement and what it should pursue.
I'm excited to check that out.
Well, as you may have mentioned, I think you mentioned a few minutes ago that I published an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. That comes from the work for this new book, explaining, for example, to take again a Bay Area example, it focuses on San Mateo, explains how a civil rights group in San Mateo could begin to take some action to redress the segregation that was unconstitutionally created in that community.
Did you get any hope from the Moms for Housing in West Oakland? Did you follow that at all?
Well, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful by the not only by that, but by the whole Black Lives Matter demonstrations that took place across the country after the murder of George Floyd. 25 million people participated, many of them white. We're having, as I said earlier, a more accurate and passionate discussion about race than we ever have had before in American history. Now, it has to go beyond discussion. It has to go beyond chanting and sign waving. It's got to get organized with a program to redress segregation. But so I'm hopeful, I'm not confident, but I'm hopeful that out of the greater awareness that we have now about this, that a new civil rights movement can emerge.
I too believe that is what we need to try to remedy some of these problems that are affecting my community. I live across the street from a very large homeless encampment in West Oakland, and it grows exponentially every month. I share your optimism.
Good.
I'm just upset, probably as you are, that, you know, I feel like these movements kind of come out of massive tragedy. Like, we keep seeing young men and women murdered by the police. And it's hard to watch.
Yeah.
Well, I know you're a busy man. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law, one of my favorite books. There's going to be a link to the book in the description of this show. Is there anything else you need me to link?
Well, why don't you link that article from the Times a couple of weeks ago? If you need me to send you the link, I will do it.
Definitely. Yeah, please do. Please send it to me. I have some older links. I don't have the most recent article.
All right.
So thank you. I'm going to play some music, and don't hang up.
Thanks very much.